Welcome. You are listening to the Park Avenue Synagogue podcast, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's better to hear it live, this is the place to catch the latest sermon, conversation, and select program. If you like what you're hearing or want to learn more about our community, check out PASYN.org. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to get a notification for our next episode. Enjoy and see you in shul. Shalom and welcome to Park Avenue Synagogue Podcast. This is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove, where we bring to you the conversations that are necessary and urgent in the Jewish world, or just the conversations I want to have. And these days are tough days, and I think what makes this moment particularly curious is that we have just entered into and are moments away from the festival of Purim, where you are actually commanded to be happy. Nichnas Adar Marbim Besimcha, we are commanded to feel joy, and it is a tough time to feel joy. It is a time that we are living in the shadow of October 7th, and we are seeing and hearing the news out of Israel, and it's not good. It's not good. Our hearts are broken, and we ask ourselves, is it okay to laugh? Is it okay to be funny during a time of crisis? Which is why we have my dear, dear old friend, Joel Chasnoff, here with us on Park Avenue Synagogue Podcast. Joel Chasnoff is a stand-up comedian. He is the host of the podcast Inside Israel, which everybody should download wherever you get your podcasts, Inside Israel. And he is the winner of the National Jewish Book Award for his most recent book, Israel 201, which I hope to ask him a few questions about. He is a Chicago native, where our friendship began. Neither of us had gray hair. Joel was a lone soldier in the IDF Armored Corps, an experience he chronicled in the comedic memoir, The 188th Crybaby Brigade. He lives in Ranana with his family. Joel, it is great to reconnect.
Wow, long bio. It is great to reconnect. And you're right about the gray hair.
But you are a very good-looking man.
Oh,
and I'm enough to share that with all our listeners. So, Joel, let's start with the theme by which I began. Is it okay to laugh in a moment of crisis?
Well, of course, I think it's absolutely okay and necessary. I'll preface this by saying that in Israel, there's a lot of great humor happening right now. And it was happening the week after October 7th. And it really struck me that it wasn't, of course, making fun of what happened on October 7th, God forbid. It was making fun of how Israelis react and how Israelis unify and start cooking for each other and trying to solve the problems by themselves and just poking fun at the Israeli personality. And the fact that Israelis are laughing, I think kal vachomer, all the more so gives us everywhere else to permission to laugh as well. But I've been performing since October 7th. The stand-up act has changed a bit, of course, but audiences have really loved it and they've thanked me for the therapy as
because
well.
Because people need the escape, or because people just need a vehicle to give expression to their grief, or I don't want to hyper-intellectualize a good joke,
I think it's the escape. It was good to laugh for an hour, and then I can go back to the mourning. That's something I've heard. But also just to remind them that there's a lot to celebrate, too. Israel means so much to so many people, and I think a lot of their Israel memories and experience has been overshadowed by October 7th, and they like being reminded that, yeah, there's a lot of fun, absurd stuff that we can enjoy as well. So it's kind of putting that whole Israel puzzle together for them.
And people are responding, meaning that you got hostages, you got a war, you have people with family who are displaced, people.
I mean, look, at every show, I acknowledge what's going on. So sort of the elephant in the room that, hey, it's okay to laugh, and I'm glad we're doing this, and now let's talk about Israel. And that sort of is a good segue into it.
So, as someone who has performed, I knew you back in the States. Now you're performing in Israel. What is the key difference between Israeli humor and American Jewish humor, right? I know whether from Borscht Belt humor to, you know, Seinfeld and everything in between, this sort of self-deprecating, you know, brand of humor. But how does that compare to Israeli humor?
Yeah, what I would say is that Israeli humor is very Israeli, by which I mean it's very in your face, it's very direct. If you go to a comedy club in Israel, people want to sit in the front row. They want to be called up on stage and brought into the act, whereas in America, the front row is usually empty. You don't want to get called in. You don't want to be made fun of. But Israelis want to be picked on and want to be in the act. Also, there's no such thing as too soon in Israel. You know, in America, we'll say, hey, it's too soon. In Israel, it's never too soon. The humor begins almost immediately, and nothing is out of bounds. A lot of dark humor, a lot of gallows humor. There's only one topic. When researching the book, Israel 201, we have a couple chapters on comedy in Israel. And there's one topic that comedians told us you cannot joke about, and that is Israeli soldiers who've been killed. That's the only topic they won't touch. But everything else is game, including suicide bombs and terrorism and war, living through war, and azakot, the sirens. So all of that is on the table for Israel, and there really are no boundaries.
And what was your, remind our listeners, your story. So you served in the IDF, you performed in the States, you had this great bit about, what was it, about cheerleaders. Yeah. I remember you doing the...
Cheerleaders in Jewish day school.
Right. What was, remind us about the cheerleaders.
The Schechter lie and say hello. And then the cheerleaders would introduce themselves, you know, Malka and Rivka Chaya, and, you know, names you don't normally hear cheerleaders using when introducing themselves. But yeah, I went to Schechter in Skokie, Illinois, Camp Ramah, moved to Israel after college and served in the IDF for a year as a lone soldier, then came back for 20 years, comedy and writing in the U.S., and then in 2016, moved with my wife and four kids to Israel, and we're living in Ra'anana now.
So if you don't mind me asking, but, you know, if you did, then this will be a very short podcast.
You already told me I'm a good-looking man, so I think everything has been...
I did that for your wife. She wanted me to boost you up a little bit.
Thank you.
What prompted you to make Aliyah?
It's a great question. A few things. Number one, I wanted Dorit, who's a Sabra Israeli. Dorit and I wanted to raise the kids in Israel at some point. And we reached a window where our twins were at that point 15. And we knew that if we waited any longer, we'd probably lose it. That window would close. And so that was one factor. It's just the age of the kids was as old as they could be, and we could still make Aliyah and get away with it. Number two is career-wise, I felt like I'd done everything I wanted to in the States. Now, look, I'm still coming back every 2 months to tour for various reasons. Economically, Israel, it's hard to make it in Israel on the shekel. And everyone I know who has a good life there is either in high tech or show business or real estate, or they have some sort of income from a foreign country. And for me, it works to keep coming back to the US. But I did feel career-wise, I achieved what I wanted and wanted to take this new adventure and live in Israel. And third, it's the wife also, Dorit, always felt like she wasn't her full self in the U.S. We had a great community. We lived in Riverdale and then New Rochelle, and the kids went to a great day school, Carmel Academy, which is no longer there, and we have wonderful friends. But in terms of the Israeli personality and Dorit, she felt a little stifled, and there was a part of her that just couldn't be fully alive anywhere but Israel. And that's another reason we went as well.
And that brings us to the new publication, Joel Chasnoff and Benji Lovett, a book that is a recipient of awards, Israel 201, Your Next Level Guide to the Magic, Mystery, and Chaos of Life in the Holy Land. So where does it, are these your reflections of now? I mean, I'm used to books that are called Israel 101. So
exactly.
What does it mean to be Israel 201?
Well, Benji and I, and just quick on Benji, he's a comedian as well from Dallas, Texas, moved to Israel 17 years ago, and we're close friends. We decided we wanted to write a book for Israel's 75th birthday, which was not the 101, not the same old narrative that everyone has been telling about Israel, about green lines and disputed territory and wars. We wanted to tell the 201, a deeper level. So what we do, we took 75 aspects of Israeli life that most people don't know about, whether it's why there are so many cats in Jerusalem, or ethics in the Israeli army, or Israel's Arab population.
By the way, why are there so many cats in Jerusalem?
Well, the British brought the cats to get rid of the mice. Do you see mice in Israel?
No.
So it worked. But here's what's fascinating. The cats, like so many issues in Israel, have become a Jewish problem because of Tzar Ba'alei Chaim, which is the concept of not being cruel to animals. There are many European countries that have a stray cat problem, but they solve it in ways that Israel will not, because we refuse to be cruel to animals. Like catch, spay, neuter, we don't do in Israel.
And so that...
So that's one of the reasons.
Along with 74 other issues.
Yeah, so that and 74 other aspects of Israeli life that we explored with a really short essay. It's made for people who don't want to read long books.
And so, you can sort of dip into one and you don't need to read them all 75 in order. You can dip it in as you're falling asleep.
And look, it's also, what we're proud of is that it's not a Disneyland rah-rah Israel book where everything's perfect.
Right. I noticed you talk about church state or synagogue state
synagogue
issues.
State.
You don't really pull any punches on
marriage and divorce and why it's... The playing field is not equitable for women and also the people who are trying to change it.
Right. So it's not just about the crisis narrative. It's not just a Israel right or wrong book. It's written with a sweetness, an intimacy, but it's also, I don't want to say an expose, but it's a full look at what it is to, and it's also explaining this thing called Israel. I mean, this isn't translated into Hebrew, right?
Not yet.
This is meant for, that would be fascinating, what Israelis would think about an American's take on Israeli life.
Well, going back to your first question about humor, is Israelis love to be told what other people think of Israelis. And I was figuring out when I did comedy in Israel, what would my act be? Would it be making fun of Jewish day school and summer camp? And what I realized is those are the jokes for the American Jewish community, but in Israel, just show them Israel through my eyes, and they love it. Israelis love to be made fun of. They love to see their country reflected through someone else's point of view. And so that's how the humor works, and I think they would appreciate it. Those Israelis who've read the book have said they've enjoyed it too.
So in that sense, right, you've devoted your life to comedy, but comedy is, there's a kernel of truth in everything. We're poking fun right. at our own foibles and weaknesses and giving ourselves room to laugh. So if we made you king of the Jews, right?
I like it.
And you were tasked with the challenge of telling Israelis what they really needed to understand about American Jews. Hmm. And American Jews, what they really needed to understand about Israelis.
Oh, my.
If you were sort of the Melitz Yosher, if you were the translator, the intermediary between the two, what is it that American Jews don't get about Israelis and the other way around?
A few things come to mind, and I don't know if I'm going to answer your question directly, but
that's never stopped.
Related. Right. So one thing... There's been a lot of emphasis on birthright and sending young American, North American Jews and from all around the world to Israel. But I think one of the healthiest things for Israel is to have young Israelis come work at summer camps in America, because they can see that it's possible to be Jewish in ways that they literally never imagined. For them, it's either you're religious or you're nothing, and there's not that in between. When they come here and they see guitars as part of the service, or when they say women and men sitting together and women reading Torah, it evokes in them an idea that Judaism can be something positive and something they enjoy and not just the Judaism they grew up with. So that's one thing I would want Israelis to know, that you can be Jewish in ways that are different than the ones you were presented. For American Jews, what comes to mind is the army and just how much the army influences every aspect of Israeli life, including how parents raise their children. It's so different to raise a child knowing that when that child is 18, they will enter the military, and it affects how parents relate to their children, and it obviously impacts how we see all the conflicts. And a lot, I myself have thought to myself, it's so easy to be in the U.S., whether Jewish or not, and protest what's happening in Gaza, or call for a ceasefire, and not not realizing what it means to have your own child be the one who would be sent off to fight that war, or just living on the border so close to our enemies. And so I don't, maybe it's that Americans in general don't realize how personal our conflicts are there, because war in America is usually fought thousands of miles away by faceless soldiers that we don't know. And in Israel, it's our sons and daughters and our neighbors.
So just to build on that,
sure,
or go in a different direction, let's see what comes out of my mouth. You're in a unique position because you grew up in the States, you now live in Israel, you served in the IDF, you have children who are both in American schools and then in the IDF themselves. Right. When American Jews debate, right, one state solution, two state solution, protest judicial reform, don't protest judicial reform. I mean, do we have any business doing that? I mean, now that you can see it from both sides, right? You know, so, and you know American Jewry, you know that so much of who we are as American Jews is given expression by what we say or don't say about Israel.
So I'm going to be completely dugri, and dugri is a word that I introduce in the book. It's actually an Arabic word that means straight. Like when you're giving directions in Arabic, you'd say go dugri, 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 which means go straight. But in modern Hebrew slang, dugri means straight to the point, honest. I'm not going to pull any punches. What I feel dugri about the question you just asked, I think a lot, first of all, I find a lot of gaps in the knowledge of American Jews with regard to Israel, even like who the players are. Who is Itamar Ben-Gvir? What does he stand for? Who is Smotrich? What is Netanyahu's vision for the future? So some of those holes, I think, need to be filled before we can make judgments and give opinions about what should happen in Israel. But also not realizing fully the implications, for example, the occupation and what's happening in the West Bank. If we continue to have settlers in the West Bank, eventually my son, when he's a soldier, might need to go into the West Bank to defend them, and I don't want that to happen. So it's really easy to be here and to say no two-state solution, or we don't want to give up any part of Yehuda and Shomron, the West Bank. But if you're not the one whose child is going to go and defend it, I think that's going to color your perception of the situation. And Israelis are the ones who send their children to defend the country and to die, God forbid, for the country. And unless you're there living, I think you do forfeit a little bit of your right to, you should have an opinion, we should have a stake, but you need to fully understand what's on the line for Israelis in these situations.
Right. I can only reflect that I think one of the changes of the, what was it, 8 months of the judicial reform protest.
Right.
I think that it opened what was treif became kosher.
In terms of what?
In terms of American Jewry's ability to speak openly about their objections to the Israeli government. Because when you saw half of Israel protesting the government, and you actually had some people who had based their careers telling American Jews to butt out of Israeli politics, say, no, we actually need you. And actually, if half of Israel is saying this isn't cool, then you know, our closest friends outside of Israel, you can say that now. And so that, I think, now that was prior to October 7th, but that was a sea change. Now it's all ancient history because it all preceded then. But this idea, it opened something up. Whatever happens with judicial reform, I think that American Jewry's relationship with Israel will be far more textured than it ever was.
Textured meaning?
Meaning there will be mainstream. Look, I personally spoke 2 weeks before the October 7th response, the October 7th attack. I spoke at a pro-democracy rally here, which was in favor of democracy, but it was obviously saying that my heart is in Kaplan Street.
So no longer this idea and of wherever we stand with Israel, no matter what.
And I think being the rabbi of Park Avenue Synagogue, I can safely say that I'm part of the mainstream of American Jewry.
They're accepted.
And so, yeah. So,
I mean, I remember when I was a kid and an Israeli diplomat would come to town, we would just give standing ovations, really, no matter what they said. It was Israel and that person was Israel, so we applauded no matter what. And I think you're right. It is more textured now, but I hope Jews will stay involved and will stay engaged because we do need them.
So Esther, Purim.
Yeah.
What's the funniest thing to say about the Book of Esther?
Oh, man, I'm not.
Do you think it's a comedy? We're two nice Jewish day school kids. Let's talk Torah for the last 2 minutes here. Like, is it meant to be a comedy? Is it meant to be a horror story? Is it, when you read Esther, is this like the one book of, like, we have drama, we have tragedy, we have philosophy, but Esther's the funny book of the Bible, or am I misreading it?
No, it's Shakespearean too, with the comedy of errors and, right, the dressing up and the beauty contest. Look, for me, it all goes back to Jewish day school and just Purim being the absolute best day on the calendar. And what I love about living in Israel is walking into a bakery in late January and seeing the Ozne Haman, the Homentashen on the shelf, and you're like, ah, already? Purim's just around the corner. Well, what do you think? What is the, because I don't know much about the Megillah and the nuances, so you tell me.
Short. I've seen your transcript from Schechter. My wife used to work there.
Did she really?
Yeah.
Did I have her as a teacher? No, you weren't the same age.
We
that would be odd.
Age. Okay. That would be very awkward.
Although Schechter will hire just about anyone, so.
No longer there. Look, I have to tell you, this year I'm reading it through a very dark lens right now. You know, the story about the rise of anti-Semitism,
right,
the idea that one moment the Jewish community thinks they're okay, the next moment the rug is pulled out from under them. I think I actually think the later chapters of the Book of Esther, you know, and now's not the time, but the whole Baruch Goldstein and, like, justification of violence,
right,
against the non-Jews, that we, you know, exact vengeance upon our would-be persecutor. I mean, this is all very resonant right now to read it. So, look, I think that, you know, we're just days away from Purim. I think that we're going to have to do both. I think we're going to have to enjoy the frivolity and the fun of Purim. I think, you know, Joel, you've committed your career to helping make people laugh and see light in darkness. And I think, to say something deeply rabbinic or cliched, is I think that the text speaks to our time. And I think that's, Purim is going to be different this year. No question, Purim is going to be different.
Well, I'll take it one step further and say Passover and Chirut, the idea of freedom, is still going to be different, because I personally think that we still will have hostages at Pesach. I hope I'm wrong. But if we do, what does that mean for our Seders? And also, even in Israel, we're talking already about Yom Ha'atzma'ut, Israel Independence Day, and how much will we celebrate this year? We're already talking about how this Yom HaZikaron Memorial Day will be different from any other we've had. And they're always, if you haven't been listeners to Israel on Memorial Day in Israel, it is so powerful. And I encourage you to at some point, because it really is the epitome of Israeliness. But it will be different this year.
Joel Chasnoff, Mazel Tov on the publication, Israel 201, your next level guide to the magic, mystery, and chaos of life in the Holy Land. It is a great, great book that I recommend to everyone. Joel, it is great to have you on Park Avenue Synagogue.
Pleasure
podcast.
To be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Park Avenue Synagogue podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more about our community, check out PASYN.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah.